military, in this country's two most recent major conflicts, one being in Afghanistan, the other being in Iraq. And the question that we're going to see about answering this evening is whether or not journalists should reflect and act as representatives for the nations that they come from, i.e., should they cover the news with the national goals and interests of that nation's ruling elite in mind. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce Hatem, which I'm sure all of you or many of you are very familiar with. Dr. Bazian, longtime activist here in the Bay Area. He's a lecturer here at UC Berkeley in the Near Eastern Studies Department. And he's a founder and director of both the Al-Kalam Institute and Sacred Roots, two organizations that are co-sponsoring this event. So I'd like to introduce Dr. Hatem Bazian.
Assalamu alaikum and good evening and welcome. I could leave this in here, it's not a problem. Taking a break for technical difficulties. The name of Professor Ward Churchill of University of Colorado, Rashid Khalidi, Joseph Mas'ad, George Saliba, and Hamid Dabashi of Colombia, Michael Sells of University of North Carolina, Yvonne Haddad, John Esposito, John Wall of Georgetown, Muhammad Shahid Allam, essayist, poet, and economics professor at Northeastern University, Professor Norman Finkelstein, Ball State University Professor George Wolf, who directs the University Center for Peace and Conflict Studies, and Professor George Bisharat of UC Hastings are but a few of current targets for their dissenting voices on the war on terrorism overall and the war in Iraq, U.S. invasion of Iraq, and Israel's aggressive policies against the Palestinians. A much more extensive list of academics as well as anti-empire targets can be found in the new McCarthyite website, discoverthenetwork.com. And we're just going to pull this up right now in just a minute. This is a new website that supposedly targets the so-called network, those who have spoken against U.S. policies in Iraq and the concept of empire. And their list is rather extensive of the individuals that they list on this network. If we look at individuals, you will see the list of individuals that they have with their faces, even though some are distorted. And you see in here the hodgepodge of individuals that they list. Howard Dean is mixed with Clinton, Jimmy Carter. You have Muhammad Atta. You have Mumia Abu Jamal, Mary Baraka, and so forth, Fidel Castro. And these are seen as part of representation of the left. Here's Jesse Jackson, and our own congresswoman here, Barbara Lee, Dennis Kucinich, and so forth. And this list has been out where it is being formulated. You have the anti-Israel grouping in here, so you click on it. And it gives you individuals who are anti-Israel and their names. And this actually is the most extensive part of this list. Well, I'm here. Right, so here it is. So you click and it gives you so-called. Right? I'm going to send them an updated photo in this sense. But it's part of this dynamics of targeting individuals that are essentially critical of U.S. policies as a way of having this extensive list of individuals. A similar type of project also is run through the Canvas Watch, and just 1 minute we'll get to that. And this is a list of universities, and each university has individuals that are listed that are part of the university, as well as organizations. And once again, you see UC Berkeley in here and other campuses. And this ad hominem all kinds of activities and individuals. And this project, once again, has been developed by one of those individuals that considers himself to be defenders of empire. If one reads and goes through these sites, you would find out two major names appearing over and over. First name is that of David Horowitz, and the second person is Daniel Pipes. Now, while both claim to be academics, quote-unquote, the reality is neither of them holds any type of academic position and are more recognized for being defenders of Israel at all costs and targeting anyone who is critical of their sacred cow, no matter where they are. Empire's embedded intellectual is a term that I coined with a specific definition of empire, an empire being a supreme or absolute power held by individual or a configuration of individuals and organizations. In this sense, I define empire to be a configuration between government elite as well as the corporate elite. As the neoconservatives immediately after the victory in Afghanistan began to boast of the American empire, so this is what's not the left terminology of speaking of the American empire, it actually was the right wing who began to speak of American empire and how it is rightly qualified for it. As such, we have to coin the new term, empire's embedded intellectuals. What does this term mean? The term is obviously is born out of the concept of embedded journalists, used for the first time during the Afghanistan and extensively in the Iraq campaign. In the Iraq campaign, the military was able to manage access to the battlefield and spoon-fed the so-called independent media the stories that it needed the American public to watch. And more often than not, it was a cheering squad approach to the news of the so-called independent media. The coverage of the war was more of an entertainment undertaking, and less so of an actual, honest, and direct coverage of what is underway. The question is, should journalists reflect and act as representatives of their nations, i.e. cover the news with the national goal and interests of the ruling elite in mind, or should they be observers to the truth and a witness to the unfolding history? It is often said that truth is the first casualty of war. But for who? It is not the Iraqis that truth is kept away from them because they're experiencing truth as it unfolds. It's actually the American public that truth is the first casualty of war for them because they're kept away from getting the actual information about the war. Empire's embedded intellectuals are individuals and groups constituted in a number of public and private universities, as well as in highly insular think tanks that are increasingly outside public scrutiny. Empire's embedded intellectuals are wedded into the promotion and rationalization of power. They're wedded into the promotion and rationalization of power projects and programs domestically and internationally, which is carried out at the expense of the majority of the American public and the world public as well. They contribute to empire through employing their pen to extol the virtues of power, its goals and mission, while at the same time being belligerent toward critics, intellectuals, laymen, and elected individuals alike. The empire-embedded intellectuals assign themselves the role of patriotic defenders of America, and love of one's own country is the only motivation, as they assert, for their engagement with power, while denying the same type of intention for their critics. In their view, all intellectual energies in the society should be directed at maintaining and expanding a highly militarized view of the current American empire, the only remaining superpower, which must act, in their view, preemptively on a global scale against any and all possible future enemies, including those who oppose our allies, chief among them Israel in the Middle East. An embedded intellectual is a person engaged in scholarship for a nationalist or sometimes ultra-nationalist goals. and often subverting sound scientific methods of research and investigation while asserting propositions and hypotheses from an already constructed ideological prism. As such, research questions are formulated ideologically, and evidence to support the research is sifted for the nuggets that affirm them. I maintain that embedded intellectuals' approach in research to provide further empires already constructed ideas or to find answers for powers pressing challenges on the field rather than actually engaging in research for the benefit of the truth, whether it's the capital T or the small t. And embedded intellectual research energies are focused on promoting imperial projects at home and abroad, and covets of proximity to power center. So once again, an embedded intellectual research energies are focused on promoting imperial projects at home and abroad, and covetous of proximity to power center. The proof for validity of their approach is the victories registered by empire. So the validity of their approach, of their research, is the fact that the empire is registering victory and declining fortunes of their critics. In addition, empire's embedded intellectuals imbued with religious outlook often bestow a divine purpose for the empire and its power, thus cloaking the emperor in a facade of saintly purpose. One interesting feature of these empires' embedded intellectuals is their lack of military service themselves, and having for the most part remained out of military service altogether, including those presently in the highest offices of our government. Consider two such embedded intellectuals: John Yoo at UC Berkeley, Professor Torcher himself, who called for the complete dismissal of international law in the current war on terrorism. What is more critical for the foundation of our society, a critique of Abu Ghraib or authoring legal memos that violates the enshrined laws of this nation, military code of conduct, and the Fourth Geneva Convention, which is the law of the land? Or take Professor Alan Dershowitz of none other than Harvard University, with impeccable resume behind him, calling for torture courts to be instituted in this country. Where John Yoo and Alberto Gonzalez can apply for torture warrant from a judge, this is what Alan Dershowitz was calling for. What is more threatening to our society, a critique of policies by professors or dumping our founding principles? They argue that this is a different war, but if our laws have served us well for over 200 years, through a civil war, two world wars, and almost 100 other military engagements, others that can be identified is the dawn of embedded intellectuals himself, Professor Bernard Lewis of Princeton, who is credited for much of the thinking driving the current neoconservative views on the Middle East and force being the only language that the Arabs and Muslims know. Look at the configuration of the institute or think tanks, and using the term think tanks is often problematic because not much thinking occurring in these tanks. Take, for example, the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, the American Enterprise Institute, the Project for the New American Century, the Heritage Foundation, Middle East Media Research Institute, based in Washington, Center for Religious Freedom, Freedom House, JINSA, Jihad Watch, Campus Watch, among many other, almost 54 different think tanks where not much thinking is occurring, are all engaging in promoting of empire. While addressing the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C., February 23, 2003, President Bush proclaimed to the American Enterprise Institute, "You are some of our country's best brains, that my government employs around 20 of you." So 20 of the American Enterprise Institute are being proclaimed as the best brains in our country. Well, if the best brains were formulating the policy in Iraq, how come we have such a mess with the best brains that engaged? Best brains does not produce best policy, and we have this example in Vietnam, and once again, we're replicating it in Iraq presently. Senator J. William Fulbright in 1966 wrote, quote, "Power has a way of undermining judgment, of planting delusions of grandeur in the minds of otherwise sensible people and otherwise sensible nations." If you don't know, in 1964, Senator Fulbright led the debate in favor of the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, but became one of the strongest opponents of the war after discovering that it was a total fabrication, just as the case presently with the Iraq war and invasion. Now, looking at the constructs of empire in academia, at the policy level, the choice of a set of responses or approaches to dealing with the new enemy, quote-unquote, are a result of particular forces, individuals, groups, and organizations acting on behalf of a developed agenda to bring about the maintenance or furtherance of their defined interest. We should always examine the true and tested approach of asking who is advocating policy A and who benefits if A is the chosen policy, and why B is excluded as an option and who benefits from its exclusion. In addition, the attempt often to cloud the expressed interest behind a particular policy recommendation with high moral purpose, which is often the case of rationalization for the individual and the group alike. What we have in here is the individual needing to rationalize to him and herself an action that is self-centered and gained at the expense of others, but at the same time needing to preserve the integrity of the self for a normal sense of existence. Also, on a societal level, the leader or policy-making groups need to enlist the support of the population on a project that is motivated by pure self-interest and greed. Thus, a collective rationalization program is deployed to make it possible for high moral purpose to be used for pacification of the populace. It is not the Iraqis that needs to be pacified, it is the American public that needs to be pacified so that it continues to support the war effort. We can see this process acts on the societal level might be easier to bring about than previously thought, since the society has been politicized as a group and a mode of codependency with policy making circles, and their worldview is set in motion. Theoretically speaking, any expressed interest or a problem confronting such an interest should have a variety of policy options to address it or solve the crisis related to it. Policy is a result of a complex process that has many leaders, paid staff members, influential individuals, interested agencies, corporations, media coverage, civic groups, and religious organizations acting according to their own constructed set of values. What is vexing at this time is the policy options being advocated to the exclusion of all others, including those coming from other areas within the bureaucracy that are calling for reconsideration of the policy options. Consider the infighting relevant to the Iraq war and the exclusion of parts of the CIA and the State Department from pursuing any alternative policy options in the build-up to the invasion. I maintain that a set of individuals, groups, and organizations have managed to promote a particular set of ideas, making them the effective policy of presently the only superpower in the material world. My own interest in pointing this out is centered on the predominance of Israeli-centric individuals, groups, and organizations that are effectively exacerbating the Palestinian suffering. Second is the Israeli-centric picture is further strengthened by a particular millenarian segment of the evangelical Christian right that considers the current period a stepping stone toward the end of time scenario. Third, a host of corporations representing the military-industrial complex and big oil interests likewise are jumping on the bandwagon. The forces mentioned above have managed to wrest control of policy-making centers in the United States and are employing it for furthering their narrow self-interest and promoting their self-serving agenda at the expense of much of the world. One area of interest for the mentioned forces has to do with the university and academia in general, since it does provide somewhat a challenge on the level of ideas and the introduction possibly of alternatives to existing set of policies adopted at their behest. The university and education in general has presented a challenge to every authoritarian structure, group, or individuals since the time of the Roman Empire. Empire structures are first defeated at the level of ideas before their physical demise. Since power does not take account of its own descending fortunes and views ideas expounding alternatives at the time a sort of rebellion to its authority, which must be defeated and eliminated at all costs. Thus, we are confronting a pacification program directed at academia, with the intent of silencing ideas of descending fortunes and policy alternatives to empire's drums. According to the neoconservative and Israeli-centric cabal advocates, the university's federally funded Centers for Middle East Studies have extremist, quote-unquote, bias against American foreign policy, which must be remedied through connecting Title IV funding to empire service. As the March for Empire unfolds, and the targeting of Arabs, Muslims, Asians, Africans, and anyone expressing solidarity with them, a campaign focused at academia, directed by the forces mentioned above, the goal of which is to reintroduce a foregone paradigm, a new and improved version of Orientalism. The agenda is to reclaim the lost ground to the so-called, quote, post-colonial paradigm. In the word of Stanley Kurtz, critiquing Said, says Said's major sin is his argument that, quote, it is immoral for a scholar to put his knowledge of foreign language and culture at the service of American empire or American powers. What the neoconservatives and their supporters are lamenting is their declining influence in area studies, and the emergence of a new crop of scholars no longer wedded to empire's project, even by force. As Kurtz once again laments the loss of influence in academic circles of the likes of, quote, Princeton historian and best-selling author Bernard Lewis, Harvard University political scientist Samuel B. Huntington, and John Hopkins professor Fuad Ajami, the three stooges of foreign policy, even though, according to him, quote, their qualification all support American foreign policy. So the criteria of being a sound intellectual in America is the fact that all support American foreign policy. What Kurtz and others like him are bemoaning is the loss of influence in area study, but not necessarily in the more traditional departments, where the fields overall are still resistant to the new paradigm. However, this might change in the next 10 years as the old guard is rapidly reaching retirement age. The neoconservatives, the Israel-centric crowd, the evangelical Christian right, and the vested corporate elite are systematically targeting two main areas in the university in the hope of reducing the real or perceived influence of their opponent. One target of the campaign was identified in the congressional hearing on H.R. 3077, Middle Eastern Centers and Area Studies Program that are funded through Title IV, Federal Grant Program. The hearing was a step in a process that has been underway for a number of years, which was led initially by Israel supporters in the U.S., and after 9/11 became central to the planning of the new American empire and its many adherents. The second target of the same campaign are programs funded by Arab or Muslim endowments at American universities, which are being smeared by the same individuals and groups responsible for Title IV funding hearings. By attacking both programs, the advocates of empire are hoping to silence critics and anyone who possibly can call for alternative approaches in the current crisis. We can discuss in the next few minutes the intent behind them and how these attacks contribute to the overall exclusion of Arab Muslims, agents, and anyone who is brave enough to speak out for alternatives to empire drums. Yes, the attack is targeting the Middle East area of studies of the campus, but this is, in the long run, will cover every aspect of academic discourse that has nothing to do with the forces above, and ethnic studies as a whole is a major target as well at the universities, considering the current circumstances at Colorado University. Having scored a major success in embedded journalist program during the Iraq War campaign, a new plan is afoot to create a new version of embedded intellectuals who are ready to serve the empire projects. To nurture a cadre of embedded intellectuals, recently the congressional hearing was held on September 17, 2003, to formulate a new policy of how to fund the area studies centers. In the hearing opening statement, Congressman Pete Hastra, the chairman of the subcommittee, laid out the intention of his bill by stating the following, quote, the International Studies in Higher Education Act would increase coordination between these important international and foreign language studies program to better meet America's national and international security needs. The bill also clarifies that programs under Title IV of the Higher Education Act are to support and coordinate with other federal programs in the areas of language, area study, and international affairs. Meaning that if you are studying a language, for say Arabic, Persian, Urdu, Pashto, or any of those languages, that funding should be connected to some national security apparatus. The hearing was held at the behest of the forces mentioned above. Since the Empire Project needs recruits, adherents, and practitioners at the university level. Quote, for two decades, argues Stanley Kurtz, quote, the American Academy has been busy undermining America's security, not enhancing it. So once again, the role of the university is to enhance America's security as the elite definition of what enhancing America's security is all about. Martin Kramer also laments, quote, where are the professors with a strong sense of the national interest, lots of knowledge in the field, good intelligence, connections, a willingness to recruit their students, and an eagerness to serve in times of war? He says no such person exists in Middle Eastern studies. Kramer is asking for the development of embedded intellectuals. So professors who are teaching in area of the Middle Eastern studies should not grade their students A, B, or C. Rather, he is good as an agent or he is bad as an agent, rather for an A, B, or C type of gradation. We can see a new charge given to all professors of Middle East studies and other related fields to become embedded intellectuals, serving dutifully the aspiration of empire, not unlike French and British scholars did some generations ago. The role model presented by Martin Kramer of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy is none other than T.E. Lawrence. That is his role model. And his mentor, Professor D.J. Hoggarth, who, according to Kramer, says, quote, it was Hoggarth who saw the potential of young Lawrence and helped recruit him to the service of the British Empire. Being nostalgic to such service, Kramer recalls that it was Hoggarth, keeper of the Ashmolean Museum, and an Oxford don who arranged his, meaning T.E. Lawrence, traveling scholarship, employed him before the war at his archaeological dig in northern Syria, and directed the wartime intelligence branch known as the Arab Bureau in Cairo from 1916. Lawrence acted on its behalf in Arabia, meaning that he was engaged in the archaeological dig, he was funded by Oxford University, and he was acting in the Arab Bureau in Cairo in 1916. Not content with providing a historical role model for Middle Eastern studies, Kramer's attention shifts to defend a modern hero in the service of empire. He defends none other than Harvard's Nadav Safran. Quote, a noted professor of Middle Eastern studies, who is given credit for Abi Zaid's master's degree in the field, meaning in the field of Middle Eastern studies. Professor Nadav Safran worked for the RAND Corporation and did lend funding from the CIA for, quote, his Saudi project and a conference on Islamism, and is praised for it by Kramer. You need to know that now having any type of project on Islam is the new cheese factory. So you have anything to do with Islam, you're guaranteed to get some type of funding to study the new species that needs to be studied. We need to understand their pathology. So as such, many of these new intellectuals are praised for actually providing service. A note on RAND Corporation is appropriate at this time. RAND Corporation is a nonprofit institution founded 50 years ago to improve policy and decision-making through research and analysis. RAND policy recommendations are reflective of service to power, and in the most recent period has turned its attention to bringing about, quote, a reformation in the Muslim world. Its researchers are preoccupied with Islam question, among them Cheryl Bernard, who is recommending a civil war among various parts of the global Muslim community, which she hoped the end result that those who support our worldview would prevail through our help. She has this in a research recommendation highlighting the various components of the global Muslim community, and highlighting the groups that we need to support and the groups that we need to oppose, and placing the various groups against each other with the hope that the what she defines as the modernists will prevail through our support. And their definition of modernists is that they support our worldview essentially. And recently they came up with another 600-page report, likewise, of studying the Muslim world post 9/11. So this is the intellectual contribution of the Rand corporations. Her ideas are a mirror image of those coming out of the dawn of all intellectuals and an old hand at this service to empire, Professor Bernard Lewis, who has provided much advice as an embedded intellectual to the Pentagon, thus justifying policy by the authority of his research. In his view, the Arabs only understand the language of power. And don't pay attention to Arabic, to Arab public opinion, since it is an irrational behavior not based on any reaction to our policy, or Lewis's contribution as an embedded intellectual. Meaning, the Arab public opinion or the Muslim world public opinion is an irrational behavior. It's not connected to policy. Because if you connect it to policy, meaning that people are reacting to policy. If you drop bombs on people, it is most likely they would not like you. It's not that they are irrational. It is actually a natural response. If you give them roses on Valentine's Day, most likely you'll engender some type of love. If you get the appropriate color of the roses, that is. Fuad Ajami, which actually these days KCBS is carrying his commentary on a continuous basis. So even in the Bay Area, Fuad Ajami is constantly brought to give commentary on the Middle East. Fuad Ajami, once again, is Lebanese, is the native Arab who affirms the already constructed view and paradigm, the Arab predicament, and other writings that point to the inherent failures of Arabs and Muslims to embrace modernity and democratic institutions. Not that modernity and democratic institutions was not one of our interests for the past 50 years, and we supported most of the authoritarian regimes, not only in the Middle East, in Africa and Central Latin America. So how come we don't say the predicament of the Christians in Central America relative to the lack of democratic institutions, and we only have to frame it according to Bernard Lewis and Fuad Ajami in the pathological understanding that there must be inherently something wrong. The attack on the academy is one of the most serious undertaking in the current period and constitute a major escalation on the part of those providing service to the power structure, knowing that the media is already a conquered terrain, and I don't need to tell you this. The political establishment has rolled over, and here saying has rolled over meaning that they have actually the inclination not to roll over, and I wouldn't go as far as saying that, but has rolled over and voted for the Patriot Act and granting unlimited power to conduct war for the president. The only area that has some renegades is the academy, faculty, and student alike. This should not be taken to convey some kind of elitist position or view of the university and their argued role as a custodian of the society, which often is the case. If anything, the present university has increasingly become part of the reproduction of the system. Even when it is resisting it, thus it does so within the confines of the defined structure. Martin Kramer and his cohorts are seeking individuals like Hoggart and Safran, faculty willing to mentor and tutor officers, statesmen, and spies alike for the United States, as the United States is going to need many Lawrences, many Abizades, and many of these academic trainers for the project of the empire to succeed. Middle East studies, by means of reform of Title IV, the empire mission in academia can be set in motion. Academic freedom is at the heart of the empire's project, and so much so in the current war period, since the lessons of years past has not been lost on the inheritors of J. Edgar Hoover legacy. In a widely distributed and debated short book published by the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, Ivory Towers on Sand, The Failure of Middle Eastern Studies in America, Martin Fred S. Laufer and Michael Stein maintain in the preface that America is ill-served by the way in which the Middle East is studied and presented at institutions of higher education across the nation. The ill-service is the thesis expounded by the author of the work, Martin Kramer himself, who bemoaned the loss of influence of Orientalists at American institutions, and under the rubric of academic diversity, call for the reopening of the field by means of legislative intervention via funding, federal funding for Middle East centers and foreign language area studies. Reading through Kramer's book, one comes with a clear picture that the real issue is the loss of the intellectual battlefield and their desire to stop the water after the dam has already collapsed. What Kramer and others subscribing to this point of view want is a return to bygone days of old, when through fiat they controlled the field of intellectual inquiry and put it at the service of foreign policy establishment. It is not a surprise that Kramers ask, where are America's Lawrences? Critics like Kramer complained about Said's work for giving a major push to generation of so-called leftist scholars who desperately needed a manifesto to carry them over the next hurdle. What is lacking in Kramer's and other examining Said's influence in academia is the failure on their part and on the part of the establishment scholars from admitting to any of the 1960s mistakes and the U.S. involvement and eventual defeat in Vietnam. It wasn't Said's paradigm that caused the defeat in the Vietnam. It was mistakes committed by those who are the best and the brightest formulating the policy. It was under their watch, not Said's watch, that the Vietnam War was conducted. The trusted and wise hands of the traditional embedded scholars that the war was carried out, and no prediction of defeat was forthcoming from any of them. Kramer's critique of current scholars in the field of Middle East studies hinges on their inability to, quote, anticipate the Palestinian explosion, the Lebanon civil war, and the collapse of the Shah. Events threatened U.S. interests and lives. That, for him, is a concern. For me, the question could be turned back to Kramer and the embedded intellectuals themselves. Why he or those who work with him did not forecast these major events while being at the helm in the imperial court? You're asking those who were outside the imperial court to predict what happens, while you who were at the imperial court have not predicted any of these events yourself. Why did the embedded intellectuals next to the Secretary of Defense, Rumsfeld, and Assistant Secretary Wolfowitz did not predict or plan for the mess in Iraq? Do you blame Edward Said's Orientalist paradigm for this, or the lack of any intellectual rigor? A cakewalk was not Said's or any of the intellectuals in the Middle East centers formulating the policy in Iraq. It was the embedded intellectuals' terminology. The Washington Institute for Near East Policy is mainly interested in any challenge to the dominant political outlook in America concerning Israel and the impact it will have on future policymakers and laymen alike. In this context, the link between academic paradigms and U.S. foreign policy is direct and has an immediate economic, military, and long-term political implications. In America, Israel's defenders will go the extra mile to make sure that their golden goose laying yearly golden eggs worth upward of $6.9 billion is never harmed, tampered with, or challenged by anyone. The interest for individuals, groups, and organizations in this period and phase of empire is direct. Since the university, being the depository of future leaders and the primary avenue for structure and system reproduction, then it must be kept within the framework of existing foreign policy options. When it comes to U.S. empire thinking and Israel in the Middle East, this takes many forms, including student groups, like the groups that we saw, Student for Academic Freedom, faculty exchange programs, study abroad in many of the universities in the Arab and Muslim world, and numerous academic links and conferences. The end goal of it is to keep U.S. unquestionable economic, political, and military support to Israel and the project for empire on the march. The university must be kept in line when it comes to the Middle East, as much as it impacts U.S. relations with the region as well as Israel. What we have here is a call for maintaining a Middle Eastern studies, quote-unquote, diversity, through Israeli lens approach, i.e., the research questions are to be formulated with how does a particular case study impact Israel first, then America, while the subject of the inquiry must be invisible in the narrative, since the study has nothing to do with them from the beginning. When one reads Kramer's work, one might think that the field of Middle Eastern studies has been completely taken over, which in reality is far from being the case. If we are talking about academic freedom, then the number one censored topic on U.S. campuses is not abortion, racism, globalization, or anything even related to any genocide the United States has committed against the Native American or African American. It is the issue of Zionism and Israel, real or perceived relations with the United States. No single issue brings power into the picture more rapidly than if a professor or a student group decides to take on Israel as an ideology, history, and society in a critical and apologetic eye. Columbia University is a case in point. So in here, the march or the embedded intellectual are directly linked to the protection and service of Israel project in the Middle East. Take, for example, the website launched by, quote, the purported Middle East expert Daniel Pipes, Campus Watch, which targeted professors who dared to criticize Israel and U.S. foreign policy. The initial mission of Campus Watch was to list the names of professors who are critical of U.S. foreign policy, as well as expressing, quote, hostility to Israel. Receiving a massive negative response caused Pipes to alter the mission of the site, but continued to provide information and links that promotes his self-defined U.S. interest and immediate links to his Israeli interest as well. If you examine Campus Watch materials, you will find a common thread on all the people who were initially listed or have files that can be obtained via search is their critique of Israel's policy and U.S. continued unquestionable support for that policy. In this context, the slick nature of the Israel-centric individuals as part of the first campaign is the immediate connections between U.S. national interest and Israel national interest make him appear to be one and the same. At this time, before going further, we need to make sure that when we're speaking about Israel-centric individual, it is those individuals that have a priority of protecting Israel interest in the United States, and that at least informs and directs much of their activities in the United States. Now I'm going to jump in here. That's a long quote. I want to skip. Looking at the success of the neoconservative paradigm in the past 3 years and its contribution toward preparing public opinion for an Iraq invasion, we can talk of their think tanks, intellectual foundations, position papers written by scholars in the field. And if you look at those who promoted the Empires Project, you have Daniel Pipes, you have Kramer, you have Bernard Lewis, you have, from the political arena, Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, Martin Peretz, Stanley Kurtz, Fuad Ajami, Richard Pearl, Paul Wolfowitz, all belong to this group of the neoconservatives. And the mobilization for an eventual policy adoption that brought about an invasion of a sovereign state. We can readily see the success of a process that did not begin in intellectuals holding a particular world, that begins in intellectuals holding a particular worldview, and their steady work on its behalf for a period no less than possibly 20 years, from the early days of the Reagan administration. Now, we could say that the paradigm discussion is boring on the theoretical level, but if you translate it into specific policy initiatives and recommendations, then it becomes far more relevant and accessible. The neoconservative view of the Middle East and their paradigm shift was formulated as a policy initiative first and foremost for Israeli leadership, which then was imported lock, stock, and barrel into the American political process. As such, the criticism by intellectuals of the neoconservative paradigm was maintained within the defined scope, and Israel-centric individuals made sure to only define this project as serving U.S. national and strategic interests, rather than the other way around. The initial success of the neoconservatives is partly due to the work of many of the think tanks that were proliferating in Washington, D.C. The other half of this success points somewhere closer to home, which is my second point, the evangelical Christian right. The Evangelical Christian Right Coalition, espousing a right-wing messianic agenda of the Middle East. What is most profound is the marriage that was struck between the Evangelical Christian Coalition and Israel-centric forces in the U.S. and abroad. As often the case, politics makes for strange bedfellows. But no one from the time of Moses and Jesus would have thought such a wedding would have been possible, even if it was a shotgun wedding at that. The prominence of this most profound alliance over the past few years will have a far-reaching effect and implication for U.S., for the United States, the Middle East, and the world. One point must be put forth in the beginning. The Evangelical Christian Right Coalition, while powerful in many political and social circles, it fundamentally lacks the intellectual foundation necessary to shape public opinion across party lines and across generations when it comes to the Middle East. Once again, going back to the Evangelical Christian Right, the theological arguments of the Christian Right of the imminent return of the Messiah might hold sway on Sunday and among worshippers, but that by itself can't move towards policy recommendation. However, once it's wedded into with the Israel-centric approach, then the needed rationalization for this worldview can be actualized. It should not come as a surprise to many that there is an inherent conflict between the evangelical Christian right and the Israel-centric individuals. The return of the Messiah would usher in the conversion of Jews into Christianity, and those who refuse would be killed according to this messianic view. Real politics shaped many of the neoconservatives who are pro-Israel to this alliance, and they welcome the current support regardless of its foundation, theological or otherwise. Supporting the existence of Israel for the right-wing evangelical Christian coalition is a precondition for the return of the Messiah, which for many of the Israel supporters is a welcome news, and we worry about theology in the seminaries. Furthermore, the pro-Israel supporters don't believe in this theological position to begin with, and if someone else does and they are ready to give unquestionable support to the state, then we will take it and use it against our enemies in this current period. On college campuses, the evangelical Christian right has been acting hand in hand with many of the Israel-centric supporters and individuals, attempting to silence debate and prevent a change in the existing paradigm. When it comes to the Middle East, we have a twofold attack on campus, one directed at professors of Islamic and Arabic studies who do not toe the line on casting Islam and Muslims and the Arab world in an overall negative picture, and for the most part to be represented as violent and oppressive, while the other target is professors who are critical of Israel and questioning of U.S. overall foreign policy and relations toward Israel itself. Often the two targets are one and the same. We could witness the case of Professor Samuel Aryan and its origin being due to his work on Palestine cause, then after 9/11 was mixed into the war on Islamic terrorism and thus handed down 49 indictments of being engaging in terrorism. This should not be taken to convey the lack of any other battles not related to the Middle East. There are, but this work intended to highlight an often overlooked area in discussing critical issues on campuses. The targets were chosen to facilitate a more concerted effort directed at eroding or bringing about control structures based on Title IV funding that would be more favorable to Israel and its supporters. During the summer of 2002, one of the main academic freedom battles relative to the Evangelical Christian Coalition was that of Michael Sells, professor at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, whose book, Approaching the Quran, The Early Revelation, was a required reading for incoming freshmen and transfer students at the university. A lawsuit was filed to prevent the use of the book on the grounds that, quote, it indoctrinates students with deceptive claims about the peaceful nature of Islam. So it should have been, rather than approaching the Quran, possibly approaching terrorism would be the more appropriate book in the view of the Christian coalition. And they are, and also in addition, calling for providing equal time for other religions. Before the lawsuit was filed, the North Carolina Appropriation Committee voted on August 7, 2002, to ban the use of public funds for reading assignment on the Quran. So they actually voted in the Appropriation Committee to prevent funding, and this was August 2002, to ban the use of public funds for a reading assignment on the Quran. And once again, unless, quote, other religions get equal time, So, in, for example, if you're teaching in the Middle East, and you're teaching the history of Islam, you can't have a reading on the Quran. You have to have a reading on the Quran, the Bible, and the Torah, and all other religions as a way of approaching the subject. In addition to the equal time caveat, the accusers, according to Professor Self, attempted to equate understanding of Islamic text with softness on terrorism. So approaching the Quran as a means of study, this indicates being soft on terrorism. The firestorm that engulfed the university was urged on by a determined cast from the Evangelical Christian Coalition, which wanted to build and maintain a negative construct of Islam in America and prevent an educated alternative from emerging. So this was the battle of 2002. I have a long quote from Sells. I will skip it for the purpose of time. This battle ended with actually going to court, and the judge dismissed the case, thus giving Michael Sells a victory and being able to teach approaching the Quran for the incoming freshmen. The focus in this regard, or in this case, was on Islam and how to represent it inside the classroom, an area not suited for the evangelical Christian right and their supporters, considering the dynamics. The case was used primarily by the evangelical Christian right to rally the troops behind the forthcoming assault on area studies program and federal funding for programs that are not fulfilling the empire's project. The evangelical Christian right marching orders to go after area studies was immediately after the Michael Sells, and the Michael Sells case was used as the rationale for the hearing that was conducted. Almost 2 years prior to the introduction of House Resolution 377, Kramer and the Washington Institute for Near East Policy recommended already reforms to the Middle Eastern studies in order to end the post-colonial dominance in the field and bring about diversity, i.e. more scholars sympathetic to U.S. empire construct and its subservience in the region. Now, reform is always needed whenever we are dealing with the humanly constructed structures. But in this case of H.R. 377, the effort is directed at legislating an intellectual paradigm into academia. Legislating an intellectual paradigm into academia after it lost favor among the field practitioners. Since Title IV funded programs have failed, quote-unquote, U.S. policymakers, then a new set of reforms must be introduced to confront the problem at hand. And this problem at hand of reconfiguring the funding of Title IV funding. One of the recommendations in the hearing is to set up a board to oversee Title IV funding. And this board actually excluded the State Department from being on the board. If there's a group, quote unquote, if you agree with the setting up of a board, if there's a group that should be on the board, it should be in the State Department since it engages with diplomacy and will put the requirement for foreign language. But in here it shows you that the motivation behind setting up this program was definitely from the Pentagon and the neoconservative and evangelical rights, and thus they had an antagonistic view of the State Department and wanted to push the State Department out. This is not a defense of the State Department, for it has its own weaknesses, but nevertheless that shows you at least where the direction of this dynamics was taking place. I'm going to jump to another area of my speech. I went to the first group, the second group, and I want to move into the targeting specifically of Arab Muslim and professors who might be supporting of Arab Muslims faculty, and then the funding that is coming from Arab sources as well. Just 1 minute, let me find my way. I'm going to jump into this particular area of the attack on specifically the area study relative to the Arab and Muslim faculty. First, we have to place the attacks on Middle Eastern studies and ethnic studies in the larger societal debates between the conservative and liberal forces in America. The conservatives are attempting at this point to mount a concerted effort at the liberal forces that are accused of causing the decay of the American society. And it is their stronghold in academic circles that make it possible for generation after generation to be lost to their misguided ideological thinking. So if you read the attacks on Ward Churchill, even though the attacks began at Ward Churchill for his statements after 9/11, it immediately shifted to a complete attack on ethnic studies, and those who formulated the attacks on ethnic studies are individuals who have, for the past 30 years or more, since the beginning of ethnic studies, delegitimized the whole field itself. Notice here the utter failure of taking part of the blame for the excesses during the 1950s and 60s and 70s, which caused a loss of public confidence in their program. Now, we could say Nixon was not a liberal after all, and it was during his reign that the majority of the American society lost confidence in the leadership that was intent on feeding people one lie after the other while providing an economic program that made the rich richer and the poor poorer. Who does J. Edgar Hoover belong to, the liberal or the conservative camp in this country? And who has caused more loss of public confidence, J. Edgar Hoover or those individuals who are teaching in ethnic studies? Now, the second area of attack, as I said, is directed at professors of Islamic and Middle Eastern studies in general, and is also attacking the endowment funding, which can be traced to Arabs and Muslims, who are mainly from Saudi Arabia or other Gulf countries, and even some who are American-born. Yes, we could say that a number of programs across this nation has received generous gifts from rich Arabs and Pakistanis, with or without governmental ties. But the defining character of these endowments is the lack of any coherent guidelines from the donors at the time of giving. More often than not, the gifts were more for recognition and name affiliation with an American university for possible admission purposes, or a thank you gesture after graduation, which also is the case for many donations by others, not only Arab or Muslims. In addition, many universities suffering from a shortage of funds found a new untapped source of revenues that could be augmenting dwindling spending on higher education. The attack on this source of funding has strong racist undertones, for it implies that Arab money is somehow illegitimate or is often expressed as being blood money, as the case in New York with the Edward Said chair. Now, just to be sure, I'm not a fan of anyone who gives a gift to a university. It is their own private business. And if a government does it, then likewise it falls within the scope of normal nation-to-nation exchanges. Just consider the type of gifts sent by the United States Agency for Aid and Development around the world. Why we accord ourselves something while denying it to others? Also, how many programs are funded through Israel-centric individuals, groups, and organizations in U.S. universities? In a comment concerning a purported Arabic statement given by Professor Rashid Khalidi to Al Jazeera, Martin Kramers once again defended the Washington Institute of Near East Policy by stating that it is, quote, run by Americans and accepts funds only from American sources, which is placed in a contrast with, quote, terrorist money funding the Edward Said, which was the exact language used in terms of the funding for the Said chair in Colombia. Kramer himself includes in the parentheses, contrasting with the donors of Khalid's chair, whose precise identities Colombia still refuses to reveal. This is his own parenthesis in his writing. Another attack on Arab and Muslim endowment was contained in an article by Ben Shapiro, King Fahd's Plan to Conquer America, which begins with a listing of different programs funded by Saudi Arabia personalities, and then complains of that's an awful lot of Arabic and Islam. If all that does not faze you, his opinion, if all that does not faze you, maybe this will. All of these universities are here in the United States. A more specific example of the above-mentioned attack on Arab and Muslim funding was directed at UC Berkeley Center for Middle East Study itself and its Al-Falah and Sultan Endowment programs. In a venomous article, both Steve Saxton and Ben Barone made allegations and connections between the Sultan and Al-Falah donors and a host of terrorist enterprises. Quote, UC Berkeley administrations ignored, Steve and Ben argue, that a campus Middle Eastern studies program has accepted significant funds from groups and individuals linked to terrorism by the United States State Department. Even though that the article was published in a minor student campus publication, the extent of its impact has reached far beyond the confines of the Berkeley campus, for it has been cited many times as representing an accurate record of what was or is taking place at campus. The intent of the article and the debate it generated was to cast a shadow on all Arab or Muslim-funded programs in the United States universities through a basic 6 degrees of separation scheme. We are all connected to each other, and if you can connect enough dots on a map, then you can possibly make a case for everything under the sun, since a preconceived agenda is directing the investigation on campus terrorist links. One can argue the same type of approach used to make the case for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, as it's been deployed to smear all Arab and Muslim-funded programs in U.S. universities. They must have something that they're hiding. A number of immediate goals can be accomplished through such attacks. First, bringing public attention to the presence of, quote, Saudi-funded program at our universities. Now, if you notice, all the press right now is speaking about Saudi Arabia, right? Not to mention that Saudi Arabia has been the key ally of the United States. It's not one of my favorite countries, and I could spend a whole, possibly, semester just speaking about the ills of Saudi Arabia. But the fact that we're attacking Saudi Arabia has nothing to do with Saudi Arabia policy or lack thereof. It is basically, if you put the tag Saudi Arabia, it's immediately rejected and delegitimized. This public attention is not wrong by itself, but we are in a period where the messages they are conveying are very loaded. When we say a Saudi-funded program, then what is implied is some type of a sinister design behind this endowment. And inclusion of, quote, links to terrorism is not accidental. What does links to terrorism mean? In addition, the mentioning of Saudi Arabia is used for the purpose of generating an immediate negative response from individuals, considering the low standing the country enjoys on an international level post 9/11. If you have a new product, don't get the Saudis to be the spokespersons for it. Not to escape us also, the use of such terminology is an attempt to make some type of philosophical connection between the programs funded and those who carried out the terrorist activities in 9/11. We mentioned earlier that many in the neoconservative cabal have lost the intellectual battlefield. Thus, the need to delegitimize is a way to insert themselves into the Middle Eastern studies field through indirect means. The one defining the terms of the debate actually controls the debate, so even though the new paradigm has gained adherence in the academic field, those who operate in the power circles have attempted to reinsert themselves into center stage by means of the defaming campaign, the intent of which is to bring back to life an Orientalist paradigm. Second, the attack on Middle Eastern studies centers and professors and their Arab and Islamic endowment is a way to dismiss the scholarship emerging from those funded programs. If you are unable to challenge the argument, then make the sources the argument. In any debate, if you can't argue the point, argue the source. Then, which in this case, the Arab and Muslim-funded programs at U.S. universities. Consider the public response when they discovered that the research in smoking was funded by the tobacco industry or gun policy recommendations funded by the National Rifle Association, which is actually the case. A similar response...